From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Though the writer Charles Bowden wrote in the first person, he wasn't really a character in any of his books. The reporter Barry Graham said, "Charles Bowden is not the name of a character, it's the name of the place where the reader stands. It's a vantage point from which to view the story." Bowden's body of work includes observations about the American spirit. It includes essays on the natural world. But in his last years, he mostly wrote about drug violence and hopelessness on the U.S. border with Mexico. Charles Bowden died on Saturday and had been on this show several times over the last decade. Today, we're rebroadcasting our first conversation with him, where we talked about his writing and how he chronicled the world from his vantage point. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A critic once wrote, "Charles Bowden sounded like Walt Whitman in a very bad mood." I don't know what Bowden himself thought about the impression, but it made sense to me. He wrote nonfiction prose like poetry, and he always seemed mystified and indignant that the drug violence on the U.S.-Mexico border that he had spent his last years chronicling never got the attention it deserved. "We're killing people like it was Vietnam," he once said, "and nobody's doing anything." Charles Bowden died over the weekend at his home in Las Cruces, New Mexico. His magazine articles, his essays, and of course his books, 26 of them in all, put the natural world and the human condition in context, and most of it came from his perch on the border. Bowden was our guest many times over the last decade. We first met him in 2004 when he was in Salt Lake City. He had a lot of friends here, among them the bookseller Ken Sanders and radio producer Scott Carrier. Today we're rebroadcasting our first conversation. I started with a tidbit I found in one of his books, that he had always wanted to be a farmer.
Yeah, look, when I was a kid, I thought I'd grow up and be a real person. But I never called myself a writer till I was in my 40s. And then I realized I would never grow up and be a real person. I come from a background where writing's not something real people do. Real people get up and go to work and do things. But when I was a kid, I loved plants and animals, and I still do. So in my next life, I'll be a farmer. You know, after the economy crashes and we all go back to the land and have to raise our own tomatoes.
Well, you said you wrote, "In my heart, I'm still a farmer looking for good ground where I can make things grow." Do you feel that way being a writer, that you can at least accomplish some of that?
Yeah. I come from a people that have no voice, which you'd call, I guess, lower middle class, working class. And so what I determined as a child was I would never be the man sitting on the stoop on Saturday afternoon with a quart of beer complaining about life, that I was not going to be silent and I was going to say what I saw. And that's how I drifted into it. I'd take odd jobs and wind up, something have to be written, I'd write it. Finally, when I was in my 30s, I was deep into bicycle racing. God knows why, and God hasn't told me. I needed a $1,500 bicycle. I went to a daily newspaper, lied about my credentials. I've never gone to journalism school, never had a writing class, and got in the door figuring I'll work 3 months so I can buy a Colnago racing bike. They sent me out on a murder, and I never came back. I realized it was an area where I had an excuse to cross class lines, go through any door. Look, I'll make a long story short. Every day I got to learn something. Every day I walked into a room, I knew nothing. Everybody in the room knew everything. They'd been there. I became an addict. I've never recovered. I'm a junkie on life. There seems no hope for me.
So when you were going out to these stories, were you asking a lot of questions, taking a lot of notes?
Well, yes and no. What I learned very easily, intuitively, or I guess it's in my bones, you walk into a room with 10 questions, you get 10 answers. You walk into a room, establish trust, and have a conversation, people will tell you everything. Mm. Almost everybody is innately truthful, and almost everybody wants somebody to hear their story. So what I've done is listen.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the books I've done, I've just listened. And I've spent years sometimes getting what I wanted. And by what I wanted, I simply mean so I'd understand why this thing had happened. That's it. So I used to give talks at journalism schools and just gave up. Everybody wants to be Mike Wallace or something. Well, how do I say this on radio? That's the kind of stuff that makes tomatoes grow. I'm not interested in that.
So a lot of what you do is just how is it you describe what you're looking for from someone? I mean, so you don't feel like you're exploiting them. I mean, so you feel like that you can get them to trust you so you can
and start then, with, I never say trust me.
Yeah.
I always say think it over. Secondly, I'm not in a hurry. Thirdly, I always tell them the truth, exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'll give an example. I was in a copper strike, covered it for 3 months, slept in my truck. And one night I'm surrounded by six union guys who, alas, had more to drink than I had, who wanted to pound me into the ground. They said, you know, if we talk to you, are you going to put what we say in the paper, you know, are you going to support the union point of view?
Yeah.
I said, look, I've already talked to the CEOs and people that own the copper mine that are trying to destroy you. I'm going to file in 2 hours. Your only choice is to try and explain to me your point of view. If you do, I'll put it in. And I told them the absolute truth. Make me understand. And I'll tell the readers. That's what I do. These books and things I do don't start with answers. They start with questions.
Yeah.
Period. That I'm a student. I couldn't be an expert. I'd fall asleep. I mean, I'm only alive when I walk into something I don't know.
Yeah.
And then everybody, look, I'm not talking this as some game to manipulate people.
Sure.
I literally tell them, teach me.
Yeah.
And so if you're honest and you do that, they will. So cops take you undercover, anything.
So your book is just is not you saying, look, this is how it works. It's this is what I found. This is what I saw.
Yes. Well, what you try and do, look at it, is there is a thing called truth. The world really isn't relative. That's for English professors and other morons. People really get dead. People really get hurt. People really have joy. It actually exists. Now, in the drug world, it was simple. I wrote a book on the drug world because I'd watched thousands of people die on the line unnoticed. I just plucked one murder, and I literally thought, well, if I just go there and try and explain one murder, what will I finally understand why all these people are dying?
Yeah.
Now, I thought I could do that in 18 months, and since I have no sense of time, it took me 7 years and bankrupted me. But that's how I do things.
Taking time is the most important part.
Well, until I can, in my terms, get it right. It's not telling a story. You do this long enough, I could throw this mic against the wall and file a story on it before it hit the ground. You know, that isn't the hard part. Yeah. You know that from what you do.
Yeah.
It's there's this deeper level, and you keep pushing so you really understand why people behave that way. Like, I've witnessed executions at the invitation of the deceased. Well, I spent a lot of time trying to understand the person who asked me to watch him be killed on a gurney. And look, it was a stretch. I may not be a saint, but I'm not a cold-blooded killer. And I'll tell you the risk when you do that. If you go far enough, the other person always makes sense. You can't just say them, you know, that they're your brothers and sisters, even though what they've done is terrible.
Yeah.
In other words, nothing's worth writing about unless it changes the writer, period.
There was this thing you wrote about Juarez in down by the river, the border town of Juarez. And you said, if you go into that black hole long enough, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not going to get it exactly right, but you say you come to live that experience and then you come to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're talking about.
Yes. Look, I have never tried to be superior to anything I've written about, and I'm not a humble person. But you walk into this room, people are dead or people have been hurt, people have lost their job, something.
Yeah.
My job, or I have no desire in proving I'm better than they are. I simply want to understand them. And the price of understanding them is sharing their feelings. And as I said earlier, once you share their feelings, you can't use cheap, glib ways to get rid of them. Almost everybody I've ever written about stays in my life.
Really?
And look at, I've written hard things. I mean, I don't know how many people you have on this show, but I once sat and listened to a woman who'd been raped for 27 straight hours because I wanted to get down finally, you know, beyond what I felt were the, you know, glib language of newspapers, sexual assault. And, I mean, these things are all lies if you're dealing with the experience. I wanted to get it down. And I did. It was a 63-year-old Catholic woman who had never been married, who was a nurse in public health. And, you know, the guy had broken into her house and raped her. And things like that change you, you know. I mean, you pay a price for those, one I've gladly paid, just to understand. Because going on rape, not to belabor it, but I'm a man, I'm 6'4", and I walk around at 2 a.m., and I don't give a damn what anyone thinks. Take me on. I live in a country that I'm ashamed of, where a woman can't leave a house at night and feel safe. She, you know, I walk down to the store to get a quart of milk. She can't do that. That was my interest in it. Like, what's it like to be a hunted? I'm not hunted. So, anyway, that's, one thing's led to another, and here I am in Utah talking to you.
You know, I'm wondering how it is that you, how it is that you came to study history in college. What was it about history that you liked, if you did?
Oh, I can tell you that flat out. I don't like boundaries. Huh. And history has no boundaries. History is not a science. It gave up that preposterous notions, which is still the drug of sociology and political science. So I thought, where can I read and teach myself things and have no borders? And I even went beyond that. I studied something that's, you know, idiotic, American intellectual history, since, believe me, nobody knows what in the devil that means. So I could read anything. I could sit there and study mathematics, read novels, learn about industrialism, and that's what I did. You know, and then I graduated, got a job teaching at the University of Illinois, and thought, well, you know, suicide's quicker than this.
You hated teaching.
I hated being part of the faculty. I hated the meetings. Everything they say about academia is true.
I came from a class.
No, I'm the generation in my family that's the first to ever go to college. I had an idealized notion. This would be the place where people sit around, they get paid, they read books, they discuss ideas. And, you know, anybody who's been around a university knows what it's really like. So I basically left and thought, well, I'll run my own university, and I'll publish segments of it to keep the lights on. That's it. You know, I liked students.
Yeah, you liked interaction with students, but that's what it wasn't all – that's not what it was about in some ways.
That wasn't enough.
Yeah.
Look, it's not a full-time job.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a full-time job. What I do? That teaching didn't even take up enough of my life, you know. So I left. You know, and besides, I got tired. This was in the 60s, and everybody was cooking the same Julia Child's chicken from those French cookbooks. And I thought, God, there's got to be another dish. You know.
Charles Bowden. He died on Saturday at the age of 69. His most recent book, co-edited with his partner Molly Malloy, is Il Sicario. There's also a forthcoming documentary called Dead When I Got Here, which draws from his reporting in Juarez. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation with the writer and journalist Charles Bowden, who died at his home in Las Cruces, New Mexico, last weekend. He was 69 years old. Bowden wrote 26 books about the American spirit, the natural world, and in his last years, he wrote mostly about drug crime on the U.S.-Mexico border. Charles Bowden, you talked about, made a brief reference there to cooking as we were heading into the break. What is it you like about cooking? You do your share of cooking.
Well, it's very simple. If you write, it's like climbing a glass mountain. If you cook, you get to chop up all the ingredients, put them in a pan, apply heat, and then you eat the first draft. And it's over. It's absolutely sequential. It's sensual. It's got texture. It's everything writing is. You never finish writing anything. They finally take it away from you and print it. Well, cooking is a joy. I had the good fortune on a story to have be sent to the last cooking class held by Marcella Hazan, the queen of Italian cooking, which I went to Venice, which, as you've probably have heard, is flooded. And I won't say it changed my life, but it was just a wonderful experience to be with a 75-year-old woman who's a genius at food. And what it convinced me of is the obvious, that food is important, meaning it's worth serious attention. Intelligent people should pay attention to cooking. They not only get to eat it, it's a whole aesthetic world to explore. Well, since then, I cook. I get up at 3 in the morning and go to work because nobody in this country has the guts to call you before 8 a.m., so you got 5 hours to write. And about 3 in the afternoon, I break down, go to the market, see what's fresh. You know, I'm one of those guys you see in the vegetable areas fondling them. And I come home and cook. And it's a joy.
Recipes, or you just experiment?
Well, you know, after a while, recipes are only springboards.
Yeah.
Yeah, I use recipes. I mean, cookbooks are my pornography. I fall asleep at night reading cookbooks.
Wow.
You know, that cooking's both a discipline and an art, and it's always classical. What cooking's about is getting rid of elements, not adding elements. It's exactly what writing's about.
You mean simplifying?
That's right. There's a classical base to every great cuisine, the basic elements.
Huh.
Look, the myth is you cook something and nobody can say what's in it.
Yeah.
Well, that's a disaster. Everything you put in it should be on the palate in a proper dish. And that's what Hazan told me. Only use fresh ingredients, etc. But it's an attitude. If you really learn to cook like Hazan does, no matter what ingredients you're given, you can make a dish. It's just like a musician can make anything out of a few notes. Now, it's an escape from writing, as I say.
Yeah.
Writing never ends.
Yeah.
Cooking, well, look, after an hour or two, you eat it or die. Or both.
Is there one particular meal, for example, maybe from Marcella or something else that you remember? You still remember that experience?
No, what I remember is the elementary sauces. There's almost no sauce in Italian cooking that takes longer to make than it takes to heat the water for the pasta. You know, I was with, I'll tell you a Marcella Hazan story. You know, she chain smokes. She's got a big tub of butter, a big tub of salt, and she's there flinging this in, and I'm making notes. I'm supposed to write this story. And I said, Mrs. Hazan, has anybody ever mentioned to you that some of your way you cook may not be healthy? And she takes a cigarette out of her mouth and looks at me and says, Chuck, who wants to die with a healthy body? Goes back to cooking. And I must say, she just turned 80 and is still rolling along.
Do you remember when you first saw the desert?
Yes. April 1957, from the window of a Southern Pacific Railroad car. I'd been raised in an apartment in Chicago. I'd never had my own yard. I'd never been allowed to have a dog since I was 3 when we moved in from the farm. And I fell in love with it at first sight, with the immensity.
That's what got you.
Yes. I mean, people either see the desert two ways. They see it the way I saw it, space,
yeah.
Freedom,
yeah.
Or they start counting what's missing. The second group is hopeless. There's nothing missing in the desert. What you see is life written so plainly you can understand it. You get in the swamps of Louisiana, the forests and prairies of the Midwest, where I originally came from, and there's so much life, biomass, things, that it's hard to sort it out.
Mm.
The deserts is, you know, it's stark, simple, and direct. Resources are no longer an abstraction. All those terms they use in ecology are slapping you in the face. You get it instantly. Well, I fell in love with it. I don't like any place with clouds. I realize rain is necessary, but I think when we redesign the world, it should only rain at night so it never interferes with sunshine. And I want less water in the West, so there'll be fewer people. When I was a boy, I moved to a city of 150,000. That's now 900,000. Well, I'm here to tell you it was nicer at 150,000. I could ride my bicycle and be in wilderness. Now I have to wear out a set of tires.
So did you decide right then that I'm going to live here in the desert?
Yes. God smiled on me. My family moved. My father was a retired civil servant because my sister, who was 2 years older than I was, had severe asthma, and the doctor said, you'll lose her, so they had to go to a dry climate, so they moved to the desert. A year later, my sister was in the marching band at high school, and I thought, my God, if she'd recovered a year earlier, I'd have been trapped in Chicago till the end of time. So I'm one brother who's deeply grateful to his sister. She liberated me.
Mm-hmm. You went, your good friend Ken Sanders took you yesterday to the West Desert. Is that the first time you'd seen that?
No, not really. I mean, I've driven across the state. Utah is the most beautiful state left in the Union. I mean, California's finished. I'm old enough, I'm 59, that I knew California when there was actually places without people. But Utah is the most beautiful state. But no, I know that kind of desert. And frankly, where I run around is more severe than that in a sense. My favorite part of the desert in Mexico and Arizona is 1 inch of rain a year. Wow. And a lot of years there's no rain. The Pinacate, the Cabeza Prieta, the Tule Desert, the Lake Chuquilla. It's totally uninhabited naturally. And I find it serene. You know, I've done things like walk 200 miles and never see a footprint except your own. Well, that's a gift, yeah. You know, on this crowded planet. And in fact, that's one of my hobbies, trying to save it. You know, one tries to make the world better. It's a lot more fun than making it worse.
So do you, when you start writing, do you have this intention of a book? Or could it be an article? Could it be an essay? Could it be something that you discard? Or when you sit down, you know, when you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you start writing, you think, okay. I mean, by the time you're into the book, I guess you know it's a book. But when you start, is it a book in your mind?
Well, yeah, when I start books, they're books, but yeah. I'll have to explain that. I have started books with just a title I've taped to the wall. Everything I write is about a question I don't know the answer to.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going to happen. I just finished a book that I told the publisher would be 200 pages long, da, 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 da. And when I finished the draft in 6 weeks, it was 458 pages, and I needed either intervention drugs or something. I don't trust things that turn out the way I plan, because books at work come alive and tell you what to do, and after a while, you're just a transcriber for this thing you call the book. So that's been my experience. I have never written a book where the outline couldn't be fitted on a matchbook.
Really?
You know, that. I've written some intricate books. I wrote a long history of the savings and loan crisis and wrote the entire outline on a cocktail napkin about Charlie Keating. Sure. He was a poster child. And I wrote a long history of the drug wars between the United States and Mexico, and the outline was just as long. The book I just finished writing, the outline, was 12 words.
Wow.
You know.
That was before you started writing.
That's right. That's right. It's an odd book. It's about an undercover, a cop who's been undercover for 22 years, living his cover, who I became friends with. It's not really about police work as much as what happens when you live past all boundaries. What do you learn about life?
Well, that seems to be a theme. I mean, the drug war book wasn't so much about the drug war as it was the people who populate those cities in the drug war. Is that right?
Well, it was about that, and it was about the bankruptcy of American policy. Look, I will save your listeners a lot of time. The drug war is over. We lost. There's nothing going on now except the slaughter of people who are in the drug world. Half the inhabitants of U.S. prisons are in for drug offenses. There's 1.5 million people a year in our country arrested for drug offenses. Half of those are for marijuana. Our prison systems are overflowing, and thousands of people are murdered every year over drugs. Yesterday I had to give a speech to the annual meeting of the 10th Circuit Federal Court and told them what I've just said. But this didn't happen overnight. That I went into this book trying to explain a secret war that's not reported.
Yeah.
That's it. Thousands of deaths. I think we've lost, more people have died in the drug wars than died in the Vietnam War. This is a slaughterhouse. And I based the book off the murder of one man. His brother was a big guy in DEA. And, of course, I became friends with him. Yeah. I mean, with the brother who's in DEA, we're still friends.
Yeah, Phil Jordan.
And it's about, his name's Phil Jordan. His brother was Bruno Jordan. Bruno Jordan was slaughtered in a K-Market parking lot January 20th, 1995, and the case has never been solved. And that's what happens in the drug world. You just die, and there is no explanation.
I want to have you read an excerpt, if you would, from the book you're talking about, Down by the River.
Sure, as long as there's no big words.
You wrote that.
I use crayons. This is an ink. All right. The drug business lacks any honest metaphors. The common ones, such as drug lords and drug czars, are falsely grand. It is simply a business. And like all businesses, it has merchants. And like all merchants, they have power and access to people in power. The merchants are natural lobbyists. They're strictly business. I do not think drug merchants would ever have come to any particular notice, except for the fact that they sold a product which gives people pleasure and threatens the shackles of government control. Nor would even these conditions have mattered if they sold materials that had evolved in Europe and been slowly absorbed, like alcohol, into the fabric of government and banks and capitalism. But, of course, this is not how it all happened, and so we are left with a secret commerce and secret events and a secret structure, and with enormous profits. We are left with a history unwritten, one almost erased as soon as it happens to hit the page. This unwritten history takes place down by the river, on the fabled banks where two nations meet. The official history is about the corruption of Mexico. The unwritten history, or the one that is almost instantly erased, is about the corruption of both nations. In this unwritten history, the drug merchants are almost the only honest players, vicious, greedy, murderous, and candid about their behavior. They are also the only real defenders of cutthroat capitalism, since they literally cut throats and employ people based on their talents and with little regard to their sex, race, color, class, or religion. They are also one of the few industries in the developing sectors of the earth that really do redistribute income and do so at a level without parallel in the thousands of assembly plants now employing the poor of the planet.
From Charles Bolden's book, Down by the River. So what is it? Why do you think it's a history unwritten and almost erased almost as soon as it happens? Did you figure out why as you were writing this?
Sure, because almost everybody that gets killed is lower class or has color and they don't count. Do you think if we slaughtered thousands of people in the country club, it wouldn't be on the front page of your paper? I mean, look, this is ding-dong school. The drug world is, drugs are consumed by all classes in our society. This is drug nation now. You know, it's changed a little. Half the country's a bunch of junkies to doctors, but the rest are buying it on the street. But if the killing ground crossed the line in our society and hit the two-car garage world, then it'd be in the papers. That's how it works. Mexicans don't count. It's that simple. That in the last 10 years in Juarez, 1,000 human beings have disappeared, not been murdered. 3,000 have been murdered. But 1,000, in addition to that, have disappeared. And your listeners can read their papers till the end of time and never find the word Juarez.
Yeah.
And Juarez, incidentally, has the lowest unemployment rate in Mexico. So, you know, when I say it's a history instantly erased, I mean it. That's why it took me 7 years. I went out there and, you know, tried to read erased words and, you know, I practically went blind.
You, KUER actually ran Scott Carrier's five-part series on Juarez, in which you were featured. You talked about how you feel alive in Juarez because there are no rules, that anything could happen to you, and there are no, as you said, empty moments.
A guy that likes to walk into waterless desert is going to like Juarez. Yeah. Juarez is alive. Something's happening there. My own country is in a stupor here. It's MTV Nation. I've watched it my lifetime. In Juarez, things are so desperate, the poverty is so great, the need to survive is so keen that everybody's electric and alive. It's funky. You know, I mean, I've never been to Cancun. I don't know the Mexico most Americans know. The only Mexico I know is where Mexicans live, which is a little different. And now you go to Juarez and you think, this is the future. It's being built here. I don't know what it's going to look like exactly, but these people are alive. These people have the moxie, the chutzpah, the soul. They're going to do something. I go back into the United States, and it's like hitting a chemical soup, you know. Everybody's in a torpor comparatively. I have a love-hate relationship with Juarez. I mean, I'm appalled by the brutality. I've talked to too many mothers who've had their daughters murdered. I've been to too many. I've stood there while blood's still pouring out of some poor kid who's just been shot in a gang shooting. I know all that part. On the other hand, the appetite, the desire to improve oneself, to rise in life, is stunning, you know, and to me, attractive. I'm always with people that want to better themselves, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not good at listening to whining. It's just not the way I was raised.
There's something you wrote from Blood Orchid, and I wanted to read part of this, because I think it's getting to that frustration you feel about this country. You say we're an exceptional model of the human race. We no longer know how to produce food. We can no longer heal ourselves. We no longer raise our young. We've forgotten the names of the stars. We fail to notice the phases of the moon. We don't know the plants, and they no longer protect us. We tell ourselves we're the most powerful specimens of our kind who have ever lived. But when the lights are off, we're helpless. We cannot move without traffic signals. We must attend classes in order to learn by rote, numbered steps toward love or how to breastfeed our baby. We justify anything at all, by the need to maintain our way of life.
Hell, I'd forgotten that. That ain't half bad.
That's pretty good,
actually. That
must
have been a lucid moment, my wife.
So that's what you're talking about. We're disconnected with reality?
I'm a fossil. I was born in a farmhouse with a wood stove. You know, my mother got up at 4 a.m. and started a fire, etc. We produced everything we ate. Now, I'm not claiming I've lived that way, but that's the primal world I came from. It would have been exactly the same in 1840. This was in the 1940s. That branded me for life. Self-sufficiency, independence, don't complain, suck in your gut, we're going to whoop it, and a kind of solidarity, because you can't survive in that kind of world unless everybody helps out. Chores.
Yeah.
All that. When I was a kid, all the rugs in the house were skins off the Holstein cows, that kind of thing. So, yes, I have a strong identity. Mexico was a natural for me because people still had the same ethic about work, about family, about self-sufficiency. They were poorer than I ever was. I've never missed a meal in my life. I'm the typical product of the, you know, after the Second World War. I'm soft compared to my mother and father who went through hard times. But still, I was branded. What's puzzled me was the decline of appetite in my society, meaning people really wanting things besides something they buy at a mall. You know, they seem to want to protect themselves from threats to their tranquility, whereas I guess I'm more Jack Kerouac Nation. Let's go hitchhike and see what's out there. And I don't mean adventures. I've just always been hungry. I always wonder what's over the next hill. I've never sat in a coffee shop on the road in my life without talking to the waitress and wondering what this town's like. I mean, you might as well be dealing with a savage beast. I just feed all day. And I learn things all day, and they're always interesting to me, you know. So my America is different from the one I read in the paper. It's this place I explore, that I've never worried about making a living. My father taught me that if you can't feed yourself in this country, you might as well go die in a ditch. This is the fattest nation on earth. It's got the best land, everything else. Look at me. Anybody can cut it here if they'll work hard. So I've just sort of gone my own way. I don't like working for people. You know, I'd rather be self-employed and take the consequences, one of which is I've created a magnificent tax shelter with low income.
Charles Bowden, who died last week at his home in Las Cruces, New Mexico, he was 69 years old. Among his books are Murder City, Down by the River, and really a classic book, Blood Orchid. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Charles Bowden was one of the most powerful writers of our time. His many books have explored the natural world, the darkest parts of the human experience. But for his last years, he wrote mostly about drug violence in Juarez, Mexico, and along the U.S.-Mexico border. Bowden died last weekend at the age of 69. Over the last decade, he was our guest on this program several times. So today we're rebroadcasting that first conversation with him from 2004. Somebody once described Bowden's work like this, that he drinks hard and then he wanders off into the desert for long stretches of time.
Well, I like the wandering part. I wish I could drink hard. You know, I was once interviewed by a right-wing guy demanding to know if I use drugs. And I said, oh, my God, I'm ashamed of myself. And I said, I have to work all the time. I have dependents. That I've never used the amount of drugs I should have, that I can barely fit them into my life. And alas, that's true of the drinking. I mean, you know, like any good American, I drink a lot just to support the grain farmers. But I got to work. So I drink as much as I can given the conditions, which I think covers everybody in the Republic.
Let's take a call. Michael is joining us on the line from South Salt Lake. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Doug.
Sure.
Wonderful guest.
God, I like to hear that. Keep talking.
Mr. Bowden, I just wanted to thank you for your gut-level bluntness about the problems of our drug policies in this country. You speak so forthrightly that it's almost painful, you know, when you hear the words as you put them together. It's just... some of us know the problems, and you have so eloquently put them on the page. It's wonderful.
Oh, that's kind.
I thoroughly enjoyed your book, Down by the River, and it enlightened me about the entrenched problem of our own government. I'm kind of curious. How would a person? I'm kind of like you. I don't have a journalism background, but I would love to write about these issues in a more open forum. I do a lot of stuff, writing congressmen and that sort of thing. But
well, I can only tell you what I did. Start with, you have to like rejection. Look, there's a curious fact of the publishing world. It's a catch-22. You can only be published if you've been published. And then after you've been published, they have to keep publishing you because they can't be wrong. They already published you. So to get into these publications, what I did was I wrote things on spec, meaning I went out there on my own nickel, I did things, I filed, and eventually I beat my way through the doors. But it took years of privation, misery, living in garrets. Of course, you know, I had the cheap bottles of wine, candles burning you read about. But that's how you have to do it. You have to be committed. Mm-hmm. And the only way you can do it, in my opinion, is believe so much. And what you're writing, and in my case, was I believe so much in what I was seeing that I try to control my anger. But I became enraged by what you were referring to, the drug world.
Yeah, I've gotten that way myself.
Look, my first guy I knew that went down with heroin was when I was 19 years old, that this has never been an abstraction to me. And then I was watching a slaughterhouse on the border that continues, and none of it was being reported. Nobody would publish the fact that by 1995, the Juarez cartel, a drug cartel in a city almost none of your listeners could find on a map, was earning $200 to $250 million a week. That the magnitude of it wasn't stated. And so that's what drove me. When I finished the book, Down by the River, I was $87,000 underwater. And I'm not that good at holding my breath. It has taken me 18 months to get back to being broke, which I consider an achievement.
Okay, so I've got to do without a lot of stuff and go broke. All right, I got it.
Well, what you have to do is realize that you're going to pay a price. And you'll never meet a real musician who doesn't pay a price, et cetera. And you can only do that if you got a kind of fire in your belly. And the fire in my belly has always been the things I see other people. That I've always been motivated. The greatest American play, in my opinion, is Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller. There's a scene in there after Willie Loman commits suicide when his wife Linda says, attention must be paid. Well, I seem to have been born with that in my DNA. That keeps me going.
All right.
Michael, we're glad you called.
Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot. So I'm trying to figure out, is there a way to describe your worldview? Someone I once read you described as a cynic, but I don't see you as a cynic.
Oh, that's a bunch. That also grows tomatoes. Look, it's a lover's quarrel. That I made several decisions. One, people think I write about dark things. Well, sometimes I do. Good heavens, if you want Pollyanna, watch TV. I was born and thought I was in a world on fire and still think that. And so I thought with my historical training, I would write the history that wouldn't that isn't being written. And that's what I've done. And I have a curious set of readers. They all loathe each other since I write a bunch of stuff that's called nature books. And then, my God, Chucky, why are you writing about the drug world? Go hug a tree again. And it's all the same thing to me. I don't see any separation between downtown Salt Lake City and what the world calls nature. I mean, there is no. To me, that's like racism. I don't see any separation between what people call races or cultures. It's all life. So that's what I've done. I'm oddly enough a creature of hope. How the devil would you get out of bed at 3 a.m. and write?
Exactly.
Unless you're a creature of hope.
I want to have you read something else, if you would. This is from your work, Blood to Orchid.
Once again, no big words.
No big words.
All right. I'll give it a shot. Okay. I was raised with the same sense of certainty, pride, and passion. My world was based on patriotism, hard work, and love of the land and the flag. I went to church. I never imagined being out of step with my government, my neighbors, or much else. I remember when in the twilight of the Eisenhower years, Francis Gary Powers was shot down in his U-2 over the Soviet Union, and my government denied that they had been flying spy missions, and I believed them absolutely. I was young and foolish, no doubt, but it never occurred to me that my government would lie to me about such a weighty matter. I would like to say that I've changed a great deal since that time, but I don't think so. I'm more a scorned lover than a bitter enemy. True, I no longer trust my government, nor any concentration of power. But I still, at some level, safe from my darkest thoughts, believe in the promise of life, and especially the promise of life on my native ground. Which brings me back to the book I have fled, the one I left, as the Mexicans say, en otro lado, on the other side. It is my inquiry into what went wrong with my life, my country, and my times. It is a long historical work without a footnote, a logical inquiry safe from expository sentences. I did not plan to write it, and now that it is in type, I do not really know where it came from. Even the mind of someone who wants to be a farmer is subject to storms. When I was a boy one summer on my uncle's farm, I felt the lust of the July corn, and come morning saw it all dead, green mash from a wall of hail that had swept off the plains. I could tick off all of the decisions I made while writing this book, but they are really of no matter save one. I thought it was better to feel what I saw than to weigh and measure and give number to the ferocity of this storm. What is explained can be denied, but what is felt cannot ever be forgotten.
So what I love about that is that it sort of seems to talk about the essence of feeling, and that seems to be the basis of it all.
Look at my favorite American poem. Carl Sandburg was a great American poet, now assigned to the children's room. You know, tell me if the lovers are losers in the dust and the cool tomes, one of his great poems. Well, I agree with that, Hal. I don't know what life's about or how it ends, but it's better to love. It's better to have your glass half full than half empty. It's better to go for it. And for God's sakes, it's better to be kind to people and try and improve things. Anybody can prove the world's pointless, but so what? You're in it. Any act of kindness makes someone feel better. How can that be pointless? You know, that anybody that's ever saved ground, and I have, you feel good. You can go back there. It's 20 years later. You're getting longer in tooth. You sit on some piece of ground, and it's still intact because you did something. And you don't care if you get credit for it. You don't want a name plaque. Trust me, you can live off that. It's better than money in the bank because money in the bank keeps the roof over your head. Saving something, improving something, that feeds your soul. That keeps you from dying.
You were at once asked why it is that your books didn't sell more. And you said that you thought maybe...
I thought it was good taste. I mean, American people have good taste.
Well, you said this. You said you thought that maybe it was because the books had come too early or that they were too harsh. What do you think about the too early part? What does that mean, do you think?
I may be kidding myself, but I think my readers will come after I'm dead.
Really?
You know, that's good. I won't have to sign the damn books then. You know, what the hell? I think he's a rubber stamp. Now, they were harsh. You know, we all have to face who we are. And I'm just not good at lying. One of the things that ruined me was when I was trying to buy that Calago racing bike and took the thing on the paper. I'm there one afternoon. I'm supposed to be what they call a fluff writer. I interview Santa Claus. I'm the wordsmith. I do the kind of drivel that doesn't matter. Keep the ads from bouncing into each other. And they had a bad murder where a guy in a no-tell motel, porn motel, had beat a 21-month-old kid to death. He beat his brains out against the wall like it was a club. And they didn't have a real person there, so they sent me. And I never... been involved, been near anything like that in my life. I'm 59 years old here, and I still find it inconceivable that a man could do that to a child. Hell, I couldn't do it to a dog or a rattlesnake. So I came back and wrote it, and the phones exploded. And they wouldn't let me stop. And I spent 3 years in what they call sex crimes. And I'm here to tell you, if you check your sex squad, most cops burn out in 2 years, and it ruined me. That I was forced to see things and understand things I didn't want to know. And I thought, well, by God, I'm going to change this. I made it a rule in the paper. I would never write sexual assault. I would spell out what's behind that innocuous charge. I hated that the child molestation charges were always fondling. So I wrote about a four-year-old with gonorrhea in the mouth. Let's just cut the crap on what's going on the terrace. Well, it got a little harsh. But, it changed me. I think language should comport something like with reality. If you've ever been on site, like I've been on murder scenes within 30 seconds of the guy getting shot in Juarez, well, it's not pretty. It's not the way Clint Eastwood told you. But it's ugly to watch somebody die with their brains blown out and the women screaming. So I would just write it down the way I saw it. Without apology, and it spooked people. So, I understand why everybody doesn't want to read that, but I think, as I mentioned earlier to that caller about Death of the Salesman, attention must be paid. These are human beings. You can't just write them off, well, they're just, those people. Well, they're my people. There are no those people in my world. Not a one. Okay, end of sermon. I'll be nice now.
That's the writer and journalist Charles Bowden. We recorded this conversation back in 2004. His books include Down by the River and Blood Orchid, most recently El Sicario. There's a forthcoming documentary called Dead When I Got Here, which draws from his reporting on the drug violence of Juarez, Mexico. Charles Bowden died in Las Cruces, New Mexico, at the age of 69 last Saturday. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.